Well, I'm John Fauci. I play the bass.
I'm Ed Dwyer. I play guitar.
I'm Chris Fisher, lead vocalist.
And we're the Shards.
That's right.
Welcome to the legendary Shards podcast. In previous episodes, Chris and I touched on our early years and our early like music memories and music influences. Do you have any memories from your childhood? What music caught your attention early on?
Early on, yes. First band that comes to mind is Creedence Clearwater Revival, because my father was a musician. He played in a band, in many bands, a guitar player, and you know, back in the 70s, you know, everybody had, you know, these huge towering speakers, and everything was very loud and new and shiny, and I just remember Creedence Clearwater Revival and all their songs and how, you know, not only was the music good, of course I didn't know how to analyze or, you know, interpret it at the time, but just the stories that it told are so indicative of the time. You know, it was a little old Delta blues rock kind of thing. So, I kind of went all over the place from there. My influences are wide and varied.
What was the first record you ever owned? Your very own that you wanted to get?
Okay, yeah. The Outlaws.
Really?
Ghost Riders in the Sky. Yes.
Nice.
Only because I was familiar with Ghost Riders, but Johnny Cash and the other, it was too like, oh, this is old, you know, that's not me. But when I heard The Outlaws, I was like, oh. So that was my very first own 33 RPM record I ever purchased.
The single.
Chris and I faced a lot of resistance of the type of music we were able to listen to. Did your parents have any restrictions on what you listened to?
No, not until later in life when, as I became a teenager, and it was, you know, typical of, I guess, you know, the 80s, there was a movement and society of, you know, music can be dangerous, whether it be, you know, satanic or whatever, drug related or promoting bad behavior.
Were you allowed to own Kiss paraphernalia or records?
Well, yes. I'm talking about the 80s, but
your mother was quite liberal.
Yeah, and prior to that, I mean, a Christmas present I got, I think when I was 7 or 9, was Kiss Alive 2.
Oh my God, nice. As a Christmas present?
Yeah.
I remember being at one of our classmates, Tommy Fan's birthday party. He got Hotter Than Hell.
Oh my
That's
God.
That's one with all the nudity on it.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I got K-Tel like, Dimensions.
Wow. K-Tel.
Freaking nice. Bullcrap.
Yeah. On A-Track maybe?
Or? No, record.
Oh, record. Okay. Yeah.
Elvira.
Oh, geez.
I think it had Tough Guys by REO Speedwagon.
That was good.
A couple hits.
K-Tel. I always wonder what happened to K-Tel. I mean, it's like streaming music, but...
Yeah, I think it must have turned into Time Life, because if you...
They should have stuck around because of the vinyls making a comeback.
Yeah.
So,
well,
the kids are loving it.
And the commercials are great.
Yeah,
you know?
They were great commercials.
No. Well, and it wasn't just records either. I mean, you could get the make a drinking cup, a glass out of your old Pepsi bottle, or the K-Tel, you could stud your pants.
I think that was Ronco.
Oh, no, you're right. I'm sorry, Ronco.
Now, my mother was a member of the Columbia House Records Club. Was your mother a member of that?
No, and I was adamantly warned against giving anybody like that a penny.
Yeah,
because of the trap. I saw my sister do it. And I heard it. There was a to-do because, you know, back then it was like, what, $10? You know, you get 12 for a penny or some shit like that. But then they got you.
Oh, yeah. No, well, the thing was, their trick was they had a card. They would send you a letter. And in the letter was a card. And in order to not get their selection of the month, you had to check off the card and mail it back to them. Mm. If you didn't do that, you automatically got their selection of the month.
I see.
So my mother did it, and then I was an asshole and did it. And I still, to this day, own an unopened copy of Bette Midler doing Broadway show tunes because of Columbia Records.
Oh, gee, well, that's got eBay value right there. I mean,
30 years old, unopened.
All right.
I'm taking bids.
I'm sure.
I wonder if her song Talk to Strangers is on there with Tom Waits.
Oh, no shit. I have no idea.
I don't know. I believe it is a Broadway. Was that a Broadway show thing?
I don't know. Not that I know of.
I don't know. I don't even know. I couldn't name a Broadway show
but
she
was
in.
But that was also... I wouldn't know.
A witch.
Nor would
she's
I witch.
She probably so, yeah, just sang the songs from other successful ones.
Yeah, true. True. Very true.
Tom Waits has a great version of Somewhere from West funny. Side Story.
It's funny that you mentioned that, like, Tom Waits, and I'm thinking about influences in early music, and there was a period where I thought, like, I was at the cutting edge of whatever, but it was only what I was... you know, had access to. And as I got older and the market of music or the space opened up, like in meeting different people, like, you know, you guys, you know, I discovered the gems that like Bruce Springsteen has to offer or, you know, Tom Waits, you know, we went to Zappa, you know, yes. Outside of the funny stuff, you know, the parody, right. You're like, oh, wow, there's some good shit here. And then
yeah.
I realized I had a lot to learn or there was a lot to explore.
Yeah, that's the coolest part about being young and into music is just finding those new, the next thing that fascinates you, whether it be 3 days, a week, a month, sometimes it's 6 months or a year.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I went through like at least a 3 month Houses of the Holy phase, you know?
Yeah.
So,
back when the world was actually social before social media, associate music with the people that you met that introduced you to that music.
Yes.
So every song and every album has a history that brings you back in time and certain people. And then you know.
And then when you're learning about your friend like that and they give you something to listen to or you trade, hey, check these guys out or do you know this band? It was always a challenge. And then, you know, you meet a new friend or, you know, you're in school together or whatever. And then they give you something to listen to. And then it's not what you expected. Like, I remember this one guy, you know, he gave me a Rainbow tape from, you know, Ritchie Blackmore's Rainbow.
Yeah.
And it's like Rainbow. And I was, you know, judging by the character that gave it to me, I was like, okay, you know, maybe classic rock, Zeppelin kind of thing. But at the time, it was like just the epitome of like super advanced like pop.
Yeah.
And, you know, with the guitar work and the bass line, you know, stemming from Deep Purple and all that. It's just like, oh. And, you know, I learned a lot about melody and guitar playing from that because I tried to cop that stuff. And then, you know, just interesting that the what you're exposed to, what your initial impressions are. And then when you get the music and you're, you know, 14, 15 years old and listening to it, what goes on in your mind and how you start to, you know, internalize or relate to it or explore it.
Yeah.
Did Paul Rogers sing in that outfit?
Rainbow?
No, that's a bad con. That's bad company.
Oh, Dio. That's right.
Oh, yeah, Dio. And then, you know, these off-brand guys that, you know, you're like, oh, those guys are really, you know, because they would always change singers. That was the shtick or whatever. And they're like, the one guy, Graham Bonnet. Oh, he's really good. And I'm like, and you hear him, you're like, oh, shit, it's awesome. Yeah. Then you see the guy, you know, live on tour in Japan, and you're like, that's the fucking singer? I don't get it.
Well, John and I touched on that, too. And one of my moments was when John came back from Paris and he had Alive, She Cried by the Doors. It's a live Doors record. And I was beyond skeptical. I didn't want to hear it.
Yeah.
I didn't even want to go there. And he put it in and it just blew me away. Blew me away. Opened up, you know... Music wasn't a box. It was infinite after that moment.
I would say I can relate to a similar moment, in 1980, 81, when The Wall came out. And I was so into figuring out the story and just getting involved and trying to figure out what, like, just says something. And, you know, it was it was a good experience to
all the emotions in the wall.
Yes.
You know, that older generation, I mean, they used to all go, those like art house cinemas.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And they'd play, and they'd always have The Wall and Rocky Horror and, you know, whatever, stuff like that. And then, but I mean, they would all go see The Wall and Trip Balls. And like, I don't even know how much, you know, how much they even thought about it. You know?
And just to expound on like that experience more, like, so prior to seeing, you know, a band like Pink Floyd, when I did finally see them live, prior to that was all like whatever at the time, 80s, you know, metal band or pop, whatever was, you know, what the kids were listening to, which was Iron Maiden, Judas Priest, you know, these random hard rock metal acts or whatever. Yeah. And I went to a ton of shows, you know, saw Ozzy, Iron Maiden, you know, Megadeth, Metallica, all these, you know, up-and-comers or whatever. And it was cool. Then I went to a Pink Floyd show. And yes, I did drop LSD, but it was still, I was like, oh, this is how you do music. These guys are actually way better than anything I've ever seen. I was like, oh, it's more of a religious awakening or a music awakening. I was like, oh, that's how it's done. And that's from that day forward, it set my stage to how I approach music, like, and how I think it all translates to what we do, whether we're playing for a crowd of 100,000 or nobody. Yeah. We just want to do that.
I can remember saying, that show. Man, that show, we should have played that show at Giant Stadium, you know?
Oh, yeah.
It was big enough to fit the place.
Yeah.
Right.
The Doors moment I didn't drop beforehand, but it made me want to seek it after I heard it.
Yes.
And it became a definite mission that I set about, which was no easy task. It was hard to get weed in, you know, 1989, 90, 91, northeastern Pennsylvania. You know,
anywhere.
In the autumn, you would get a lot of it. And as the year went on and into the summer, it would dry up. It was gone. It wasn't harvest time, you know?
Yeah.
Everybody didn't have a hydroponic setup in their basement like now.
Yeah. So, or in their company, their cannabis farm.
So to find that
well was, connected to have a steady flow. That's
and I didn't even get real good stuff till, hell, I got up to New York. And then, you know, but what was your first live concert, Ed? First live concert.
First supervised or parental chaperone? No,
it can be parent. Mine was parentally chaperoned. All
right, my first concert, Bay City Rollers.
Oh, no way. Yeah. Saturday?
Wow. Yeah.
Saturday.
S-A-T-U-R-D-A-Y. Hey.
Oh, my God. That's awesome.
That was great. Well, the plaid. The lights.
Classic.
How about yours?
I was going to ask John who his first live concert was.
My first major live concert was James Taylor when I was about 15.
Wow. Okay. Where was that? SPAC?
SPAC.
Yeah. Where was the bass?
SPAC.
Really?
Yeah, SPAC.
My first show? Rick Springfield, Jesse's Girl Tour.
Oh, yeah.
Nice. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Syracuse War Memorial.
Really? Oh, okay.
The girls, from the moment he started, and I don't remember there even being a band. It was like him running around the stage with a guitar. For the minute he started, the girls stood on their chairs and screamed as loud as they could. You couldn't even hear him.
No.
You couldn't even hear him.
It's funny. I saw a few years ago, there was some, you know, when radio was still kind of a thing, so maybe more than a couple of years ago, but maybe he discovered it online, but he's still working. He's still making music, and it's like total blues, and it's down, and it's dirty.
He's pretty good. And it's pretty good. Know? His killer was General Hospital and going on there.
Yeah.
Once he did that, he gave up all credibility as a, you know, serious musician. He became
a teeny bopper.
Yeah.
A few years ago, when I first ventured out towards central New York, he was steeped in litigation because when he was playing the New York State Fair in Syracuse, he apparently assaulted some woman with his ass.
With his ass.
But she was suing him for knocking into him or something like that.
Right.
Which ended up, I think it ended up going in his favor.
Good.
Well, it's funny. Just a quick, current event. So that reminded me, Ron Jeremy, the porn guy from way, he's on trial or some shit because all the people that he made pornography with are suing him for unwanted sex.
They're I'm all
like,
are you him?
Fucking? Yeah. No, he's in prison. He's he's in a mental hospital.
I saw a picture. He looks rough.
And I was like, I saw that in the news. I was like, what the? It's just so funny that you mentioned rubbing his ass.
Yeah.
And, it's amazing. And I, quite frankly, I'm a little scared. I mean, yes, I've been with other people. And what am I going to get a phone call? 20 years ago, you fucking had sex with me. And I'm like, what?
You're
only
lucky.
If you get rich.
You're lucky. I was going to say.
You're safe for now.
Oh, you great. Have no money. No, that's comforting. Thank you.
You have no money, so you have nothing to worry about.
Oh, my God.
People who don't know you will start remembering things once you have something to take.
Yes.
That's
that's when I hide.
Jeez. That's horrible. I'm depressed now, more than I ever was.
Come and find me.
Yeah, fine. Stay poor, be safe.
We'll have our own recording studio deep in some mountains. We'll fly Tim in, helicopter him in when it's time to work.
Yeah.
And just totally ice. Maybe an island. Maybe an island.
Yeah, the mountain would be nice, but I like I am getting adverse to the cold.
Yeah, but if you don't have to go anywhere, I mean, at that point, we have an indoor pool and like a hotel indoor pool.
All right.
Not the little thing, that they can sit in.
Yes,
I can. Like a freaking pool.
Well, then I say, yes, I can.
Yeah. we'll could even have that in a glass encased area so you can actually swim while looking at the mountains and the snow.
Maybe a mountain lion.
Maybe a nice space shuttle rose.
Those old 60s, 70s illustrations that were always space age.
Houses,
and be all glass and there's the moon outside. Totally unlivable.
Yeah.
And they're all always toasty, a little fire going or something. And everyone dressed nice like they did.
So with the influences and stuff that you have had, say, John, what made you pick up the instrument? Like, how did you get turned? Like, how'd you get a guitar?
Well,
how'd you get a bass?
I started playing guitar after my brother was taking lessons. He played guitar.
Okay.
And so I just started going to the same teacher he was going to. We started touched on this before, but no, that's all right. He started going to this teacher that was up on Hamilton Hill, and her father was the great Stephen St. John. They used to write all the guitar primer books. And he had an orchestra in Schenectady back in the 40s and and played on the radio. But you probably remember the Guitar Method 1 and 2.
Well, yeah. The St. John name I remember. Yeah.
So, but there was his daughter was our teacher. There was a little school they taught out of. Wherever he, probably his whole orchestra and stuff. He used to work there one day. But anyways, and she ended up teaching out of her home up by Central Park. But I kind of was just following in his footsteps. I mean, I wanted to play. I liked to play, but my brother was more disciplined and was a better player than I was. And I never, really practiced. I would practice a little bit, but I was a lot less
inspired. So when did it become I'm going to do this?
Really about the time Chris and I started writing songs. I mean, I always played, every once in a while and strum along some songs or something, but, really just us starting to write the songs and piece them together. And really is, it took on a different feel, you know. I mean, I learned how to write or read music and all that stuff, but I feel like the professional side of my playing more stems from playing by ear.
Yes.
So I really feel like both types of players. I mean, I can read music and I could piece it together and play, but, you know, it's not like I stayed disciplined to, you know, reading either.
Yeah.
And it was more getting a feel for the instrument. My brother used to get so mad at me when I played and I'd start strumming hard. And every time I did that, it was wrong, wrong. What are you doing? You know, and I always just wanted more out of it.
Yeah.
And I'd try to do like solos or something. You're not supposed to play down there. There's always rules, right?
Yes. Well, that was the thing that always saved me about music was I was always under the impression that, yes, I was not good at learning how to read and write. I have the nuts and bolts just by being there, by being present for whatever class was given as a young child. But it was always no rules.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know if that was, you know, just like the marketing of the day or whatever, but I believed it. I believed that there's no rules. And if the note is good or if I'm doing what I think is good, then it's good. And how's that going to, you know, it was actually kind of tough to fit in a lot of scenarios as a young, trying to be musician kind of guy, because it wasn't, you know, everybody had the rules and how that was going
to
go.
I give all the credit in the world to the people who really studied and can read and what an incredible ability, and it'd be able to just step in with anybody and just read along and play.
Yeah. It's so simple, but
right.
I can't do it.
Right.
I give them very little credit, and I find it to be stale and non-passioned times.
Well, that's the result. The skill to create that stale non-passion, you know, is I'm a loss for it, because you can't give me a sheet of music and be like, all right, we're on.
I need
to listen. What key? What chords? What's what?
I fairly recently heard, and I think it was an interview I caught within the last year, certainly since he had died, Eddie Van Halen, that I never heard him talk in his whole lifetime.
Yeah, and until late years.
I never really seeked it out. And it's almost something like I always wondered, and that is something I always kind of wanted to kind of keep a mystery. You know, just sort of this incredible master who...
He spoke through his guitar.
Right.
Well, he did.
Absolutely.
Well, and the truth of it...
You didn't need to hear his voice.
Yeah, well, and his who, without his guitar, as you learn and read, especially after his passing and stuff, and... the guy was, you know, that's all he had. I mean, he had money and all that from being in Van Halen. But the stories that I've read multiple times from credible, you know, the grassroots interviewers and stuff like that, the guy just was fucked up, smoked a lot. He stayed inside. That's all he could do.
But when he was young... His father was a musician.
Yeah.
Was a professional musician. His mother really wanted them to learn the piano early on. So him and Alex were doing piano lessons, and he was taking he was taking lessons for about 5 years or something. And the teacher asked him to turn a page. You know, the teacher was playing or something, and he had to turn the page. And then he discovered at that point that he didn't know how to read music. He never learned how to read music in all these years of lessons. And he was just emulating the teacher.
Yeah, copying.
And he was playing all along, and he still never learned how to read, which is crazy.
When we first started recording, I had to go get the book, like, you know, how to write music. And it was a little thin paperback that I brought back to our Washington Ave apartment. Yeah. And we wanted to submit to the Library of Congress, and we submitted Brothers and Sisters from our current project. And we're in the Library of Congress with Brothers and Sisters, with written music.
Well, and, you know, 23,000 was sent. I never heard anything. 16 stories was sent, and, like, I got an email about something, so I sent another as a backup, and then, like, got locked out of my original email, so I don't. So there's some work to do there. But the 25th anniversary of 23,000 is coming out, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm excited to.
It's the government. You can't work with them.
No. Well, no, and that's what I've come to realize, and I've been, you know me, I've been, early on involved in like the marketing and the putting together and making a package to send out and do all that stuff. And like, I was always under the impression that there's a way. I mean, I just don't know it. It's not difficult. But then as we pursued it, when I sending stuff out, trying to get feedback, doesn't work. That's not how it works. I really don't know. So what we're doing now with our projects is just, you got to let it be, let it go. And
to me,
we do what we can.
It's just about, at this point, being creative and producing
stuff,
merchandise and stuff, or just art and, you know, and making it good.
Well,
and
of all the people,
all I can do and put the faith in, you know.
Exactly. And of all the people, you know, especially our, you know, us, our middle aged age group, there's a lot of people not doing anything.
No.
So I take pride in that. I'm like, oh my God, I'm doing something.
And it still gets frowned upon and criticized. And it's like, I'm doing something productive.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, when the world ends and nobody has jobs anymore, we can just be troubadours traveling the countryside, merrily playing for a night of sleep and perhaps a meal.
Yeah. A crust of bread.
Move on to the next town.
Pint of grog. Yeah.
The first time I heard troubadour in an applicable way was when you said it so many years ago. It's like, we could be troubadours, Ed. I'm like, the fuck's a troubadour? I don't want to be one of those. Isn't it? I'll be a rock star.
Call me that.
Isn't it a lyric in Sympathy for the Devil?
It is.
Yes, yes. I still
who get killed before they reach Bombay?
Yeah. Yep. Hired soldiers.
So you get into your teen years, Ed. When does the first like notion come to you that, you know, it's kind of boring playing other people's stuff all the time? I'd like to do stuff of my own and maybe get with some other guys.
Well, in the process, so I've finally got my first, my own first electric guitar. I think I was 13 or 14. Yes, they're about there. And I knew some chords.
What was the guitar?
That was the Hondo V guitar that I had. Growing up in school, I had a, you know, my mom would send me to school with like a buck or two to go into my school savings account that I had. She was teaching me banking and all that kind of shit, and the school also. So right around sixth grade, seventh grade. I had a couple hundred bucks in there by then, you know, for a buck a day or a buck a week or 10 bucks a month, whatever the deal was. But anyways, that's where all my money went. Got it. So started taking lessons. Some local guys. I was initially taught by another rock star, Henry McFerrin, from the area here in Albany, New York, China White. And I was like, here's this guy. He's got an ad that you tear off at the public bulletin board at the supermarket.
Yeah. The numbers torn.
With the little number tabs. My mom grabbed it, sent me over to his apartment to drop me off to take a look. Here's this dude, long hair. He's got a Vox amp and a Les Paul, and it was him. But so he tried to teach me music, but I was always the show me what I want to know. So, well, how do you do this? Luckily, I knew the A minor chord. However, moving forward, I couldn't. There was no tools like we have today, so I had to learn by ear. Sometimes it was a lot of hit and miss. And then I was like, when I, you know, in the process, reading the magazines and the articles of your favorite star, your favorite guitar player, whatever, the Hit Parade, and then in Guitar Player magazine, things progressed, I realized, again, that, like, they're all doing their own thing. Yeah. And that, and I was like, I need to do my own thing. And one, I still sticks with me today, and it's kind of my underlying personality trait is just... you know, you've got to develop, you got to do things your way. There's a guideline, but if you stick to the guideline, then you're not going to be, you don't have a chance because you're just going to be able to hit notes. If you can't express yourself and develop a style and not even plan, I mean, just play from the heart, I guess.
Right.
Yeah. So that's how it came about.
So what did you start playing? Just anything? Did you try to write songs? Did you?
Well, know? I would hit a bar chord and I'd learn a song. Say, you know, so it's a G chord, and I'm like, all right. And then I would learn another song. Somebody would show me, oh, I know this Ozzy tune or this Sabbath song, and I was like, oh, but that's the same chord. And that goes boom, you know, goes from, you know, starts at G, goes up a step to A. So and then I would, you know, out of boredom would start playing. Well, what if I did A to G? What if I did that? Or what if I did A, or, you know, A, B, B, G, G, A. And I just started, and then I noticed that things started sounding like things that I was hearing. And I was like, that sounds, it's not that, but it sounds close enough. And it was always a bone of contention trying to be a music guy because other people knew how the songs went. I had an idea.
Yeah.
And I was able to pull it off, but.
Yeah.
It's, yeah.
So when does the first, because I know you played with other guys before us.
Uh-huh.
We weren't your first. So, you know, what was that?
And well, I would have to get a cassette player or a record player, and I would have to learn, like, if we're going to do, like, this is in high school now, so if we're going to do, like, a Slayer song, I'd have to scour the market, the stores, the record stores, or actually go to a concert or know somebody who knew the song. And like, how do you do that?
Well, that's all fine and dandy, but for some reason you're being elusive.
Well, maybe I'm not answering
to the question. Who the people were that you first started trying to have a band with.
Well, my friends and one, you know, Mark Villano.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
See, I hadn't until right now realized that you actually played with him before the Sharks.
Right, but I never made the cut because I didn't know the songs. So I would just have to get together and we would jam. And I'd be like, well, let's just do this. If I can't play fucking Slayer or Metallica note for note, then how about I play what I know and then we'll jam the rest out. And that's what I would do. And I, you know, that was, yeah.
What about those guys we went to the house that time and they had a Leslie.
Yes.
Weren't those guys that you had played with? No,
that was Marcus.
Were
they from your school?
No. They were a different school.
What was it?
Sound Asylum?
Sound Asylum. What was the real band?
Soul Asylum?
Soul Asylum. Yeah. And that band was Sound Asylum.
Sound Asylum, yeah.
But that was another band that Marcus played with a little bit, and they had that organist, which was pretty good.
Yeah, it was cool. A learning experience. Well, that's the thing. I mean, our drum. And then when we came into the picture and we needed a drummer,
yeah,
you know, we were with Owen for a while, and then that kind of flaked out. And then I was like, you know, Mark, being the band whore that he is, will play with anybody, you know, and do whatever he can.
Don't jump too far ahead, though, because we'll get to that part of the story, which deserves its own, you know, delving into.
Okay.
So you're just jamming around, basically. You're not, you know, like, hey, we're the Crystal Nuggets. I mean, do you have any band names prior to the Shards?
No.
Or, no. As neither do we.
No, I was never in one of those. I played with them and was on the scene of whatever that was going on, like, you know, but those people were taking lessons, learning songs, being like, this, you know, this is the count, whatever. But yeah, I was never part of
and
all that.
And it wasn't one.
No,
one,
it wasn't my one and done method.
Or 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13.
Yeah, I had to feel it. If I can't feel it, I can't do it. Uh-huh. Well, I could, but
the mathematics of music always fascinates me. But once you get involved, I'm not thinking that way anymore.
No.
There's a sort of physical mathematics once you get into a pattern and you realize where that fits and how you...
Well, that's the producer, that's the engineer's job, especially with the equipment we have.
I've never counted anything off. I think I'm subconsciously, it's all based on math, whether you're doing it consciously or not.
Yes. True. Oh, yes.
I think subconsciously I'm counting it, but I'm not doing it.
Right. You're not all right, here comes
but
the
it
six.
Is happening on because some level.
That's just too much conscious thinking.
Yeah. Well, that would take the way of
exactly. It's that's the not, most fun when you're not thinking.
It's like Yogi
just
Berra
happening.
Says you can't think.
That's why
it
I play in a band.
Time.
That's why I play in this band, because that's what we do. We play.
Yeah.
We play.
We become the song.
Thank you. give you